tell the audience about how you got started in real estate.
Welcome to the Masters in Real Estate podcast with your host, Tanner Webster.
So you had a tweet, maybe you've got a lot of tweets, but you posted one a couple of weeks ago about working with economic developers and seeing where all the single family home or the residential development is going. Is that how you typically find your sites?
So we are structured, I think, a little bit differently than other people, where we came into this from the very beginning thinking data is just everyone now has so much data. I just feel like it's going to get harder and harder to find good deals.
Yeah.
And so we intentionally were like, okay, what kind of structure can we make where we can pay market and sell for market and still have a viable development platform?
It's my dream.
Our objective really is, so like as a developer, you can spend your time doing a bunch of different things. And I think a lot of people in real estate, most of their time is trying to find deals, right? They're calling brokers every single day. They're meeting people, you know, they're spending thousands of hours trying to find deals. We prefer to set ourselves up where we're spending a little, like not as much time as you think trying to find deals. And we're trying to put all that time towards executing the deals. So we spend the same amount of time as any other developer, any other investor within their platform. We're just spending them more on the actual execution of the deals and the construction. So when we're sourcing deals, like there certainly are strategies that we look at. So following housing is an easy one, especially in Texas right now, where 1,000 to like 5,000 homes could like be planned and coming, and everyone knows it. Exactly. And everyone knows it. And those guys, none of their value comes from the commercial land, but the city's always forcing them to do commercial land. So if they're building all these homes, they might have this section that's allocated for commercial, but because they're residential guys, like they're not really looking at it as value for like their project. They're just trying to, you know, get it off their books and someone else to build it. And more importantly, a lot of times they won't give all the permits for the housing until that commercial's built. So that's an example of how we would find a deal is, we find a residential developer who has commercial land that they need to get built in order to get more permits for their housing. And then we come and save the day for them, and we get building is built quickly and they get more permits, and that's where they make their money. And 3 and 5 acres doesn't make a big difference, but there's like 10 strategies like that we can do.
Yeah.
We can run through all of them if you'd like.
Well, I want to stop. So you said 3 to 5 acres. Is that typically the site that you're looking for? Or what's like an ideal, like what's the buy box for you?
Yeah. So sourcing is a lot of, like, it's hard to be good at sourcing deals unless you know exactly what you're looking for. It's as much about filtering deals as it is about, having these clever strategies. Like it's more about knowing how to say no in 5 seconds. So that you can spend a lot of time on the deals that actually make sense. So our buy box is, ideally 1 acre is all we need. 1.3, 1.4 acres. That allows us to get 10, 11,000 square feet. That's a good retail. That's a good square footage for a retail strip center. We're really focused on depth of sites. So, 250 to 265 feet is like what we're typically looking for the depth of the site.
I want to pause. I designed my strip center exactly 265 feet because of you. So thank you for that.
Do you know how the math breaks down on that and how like we kind of came up with that?
Let's talk about it.
So it's pretty common sense, right? You're probably going to have a landscape buffer just going front to back on your site. You might have 10 to 15 feet of this landscape requirement. Then you have parking. So it's like 18 feet plus, you know, maybe a 2 foot overhang, 24 foot fire lane, another row parking, maybe 15 feet of patio, then you're 60 to 70 feet of building. You have the sidewalk in the back, another row of parking, another row. And so if you just think, you know, very simply about the every single section, you build it front to back, you can see exactly what depth you need.
Yeah.
And we're trying to really stay away from the super deep sites because you're just wasting land at that point.
Yeah, I think a common misconception is, I'm buying this for $17 a foot, but
yeah,
I look at my building land per square foot versus like your actual land per square foot, because that's, I mean, a triangle versus a square is two very different prices.
Right.
So on that, your buildings are like between 60 and 75 feet deep. Who is the typical tenant and how much of a space are they? Like 10,000 square foot building, are you getting eight tenants? Are you getting two? Like, how does that break down?
So smaller tends to be what's preferred in retail strip centers. The reason people like strip centers is the diversification. It's, you can have four or five tenants in there, and if one of them goes out, it's not like you're owning a single tenant QSR, right? If you lose one tenant or lose two tenants, like, you can backfill those over time, and you can pay your debt service. And so if you're an individual who ends up owning one of these projects, like, it's a really good asset from that perspective. So we tend to try to stay small, just because we know that an eventual buyer prefers that. Five tenants, like 2,000 square feet or smaller, like, you might end up being like 2,400 square feet on the end caps. So if you think about that from a depth perspective, if it's, you know, 60 feet deep, and, you know, that's these tenants tend to stay around like the storefront, like the really round numbers. Mm-hmm. They might be like 20 feet of storefront or, you know, 30 feet of front storefront. But we're really trying to get them smaller. But lately, I'm seeing tenants get bigger and bigger.
Really?
I'm seeing nail salons go from like 2,000 square feet to 3,000 or 3,500 square feet.
The mega nail salons.
A lot of concepts are getting smaller, but I'm seeing a lot get bigger too. So it's a weird mixed bag right now. Like, I still think the most common square footages are 2,400 square foot end cap drive through, or in line would be 1,200 square feet or 1,800 square feet. Mm-hmm. I think that's most common. But it's tricky though, because although our next buyer would prefer many tenants, I personally prefer like three or four tenants as opposed to five. And like, I'm less worried about losing a tenant and putting them back in. I just think it kind of helps with parking, because I think when you're really small, you can run that store really efficiently. But like, even a 1,200 square foot tenant still is going to need like a minimum number of employees for the most part. Mm-hmm. And I just feel like the more tenants you have, the more efficient they are with their space, the more you might have a parking problem. So it's like everything in our business, it's a very much a little bit of a dance where you're trying to balance all different types of things, from what's going to make the tenant successful, what's going to take up the most parking, what's going to make the center most successful, how are these tenants going to work together? And so it's you're constantly trying to balance these things.
When you say getting tenants to work well together, do you mean like, when mom drops off the kids at dance studio, maybe she goes and gets a smoothie? Or like, what do you mean by that?
I think that's helpful. I think that matters. And there's whenever we lease to a tenant, we will always ask him, like, obviously, you know, we're going to lease to whoever we lease to, but if there's a preference for what kind of tenant goes next to you historically.
And vape shop.
Exclusively vape shops.
Yep.
Yeah, just tattoos and vape and all that.
Tattoos, yep, yeah. Exactly.
You know, you start to get a sense of what works well together, but I can't overemphasize how important parking is in our business, especially as rents get to like crazy. It's probably matters a little bit less for the value add guys who are still doing rents in like the low 20s and things like that. But we're pushing $40 rents and $55.
A lot of sandwiches.
You have still a lot of sandwiches for that.
Yeah.
Each parking spot is in theory like a customer, and so, you know, balancing the parking. So like our last center, we got had Sherwin Williams, who uses parking in the morning, and we had Smoothie King, who uses exclusively, like, is 90% of the business is drive through, and, you know, we had a restaurant who's mostly at night, and so like the hours worked really well together, and that is honestly more of my focus, is balancing the parking. But the co-tenancy is important, and you try to do the best that you can. And you know, there's some little details in there, like power, where if you get too many tenants and they all need 200 to 400 amps, like, yeah, I might have to get like more, like there's little things like that where you can run into issues if you go too small at the tenants.
Mm-hmm.
But for the most part, I would say parking drives more than probably anything else.
I was talking to Chris Hatch about this the other day.
Yes.
Do you think you could build a strip center and have a tenant pay less than $40 a foot? Do you think we'll ever see less than 40 on new construction in the future?
100%. You definitely can. And I think, you know, there's ways to almost force that in a way. Like you can do, if you're trying to get your building to have, you know, lower rents, you can give no TI and just give zero TI deals and lower rents. You can go a little bit more where land is cheaper and, you know, get a better basis that way. There's ways to figure it out. It's just that, any path towards under 40 is probably going to result in you waiting a lot longer for tenants. And so it's doable, but I don't think it's like worth the risk.
Yeah.
And at this point, like, man, 6 months ago, maybe 9 months ago, I still had everyone scoffing at like $40 and $42 and $45. I recently had a tenant offer, I think, 38 and cab drive through, and then we countered in the high 50s, and then they agreed.
Whoa!
And they just agreed. And it's, wow. And I think there's just such a supply demand imbalance between, especially in DFW.
Yeah.
There is so many tenants. Many of them came out slow out of the gates in COVID, and they're all behind. And when you hear like the biggest names in retail can't hit their store numbers, like I mean, everyone knows like the biggest names. If they can't hit their store numbers, that means everyone else is struggling too, right? So the interesting thing about it is that the best tenants, 40 net, all for the tenants that do very well is nothing. Like, it's no big deal at all. They can pay a lot more than that.
Mm-hmm.
So many tenants do well and so many tenants do poorly. And so like that, it's pricing, like, it's, you know, it should price around like what the median, like what a good balance is, where a tenant crushes it, you know, they, that should feel like a cheap rent.
Yeah.
But it's, so I think that the answer is yes. And we're trying to do that. But it's, I don't necessarily think it's necessary. Tenants are willing to pay it.
Let's get back to, you mentioned a couple different acquisition strategies that you had, and then I cut you off because I had a selfish question.
No, that's good.
What were some of the acquisition strategies that you're using?
So we talked about, following homes was the first one. There's some strategies that are less like this is how you source it, but more like little things we're looking for. So all of our buildings, we're trying to get circulation, right? And we're always going to put in a fire lane and we're trying to park up the fire lane. And sometimes you find land sites where there's enough infrastructure around you where you can kind of play off other people's fire lanes. And so you can take a site that is, instead of 1.3 acres, is maybe 0.9 acres. And you can get the same amount of square footage because the fire lane that would normally be on your site is now on somebody else's sites. So there's little details, I think, in just site plan and construction where you're looking for things like that. We have the same strategies as other people where, like, you know, if an individual owns a property and they're not, and they live in Utah and they own something in Dallas and this tenant is, you know, has 3 years left in their lease, like but the tenant needs to expand. Like, there's always opportunities like that where you're looking for, okay, our construction expertise can solve this problem. We have a seller who can't solve the problem and it's a good place for us to jump in.
So are you getting, you're just asking your neighbor like, hey, can I put my fire access on your property? Is that what you mean by that?
It's more that like it might already exist, but everyone, all the brokers are pricing the land similarly.
Mm.
Like, this is $20 a foot. This is $25 a foot. And you'd sometimes just find fully marketed deals that are just on Crexie and LoopNet and CoStar. And you drive by, you see a sign. And it just, you just see it and you instantly see, oh, there's more site work done there than you ever get. And that probably saves you X amount of dollars.
Yeah.
And that's what you're looking to do. I'll tell you an underrated way to source deals we found is just so many people focus on building relationships with brokers. And I find that building relationships with cities and EDCs economic development corporations is just as important. And you'll get as many deals from doing that in development. I think it's a little bit harder probably for buying existing buildings.
Yeah.
But in development, I think it's because people who own a lot of land are just individuals.
Mm-hmm.
And so they probably have a better relationship with the city than they do with a broker, right?
So let's talk about that. How do you, let's say you came to Salt Lake to compete with me.
Right.
I'd love to have you, but right? We can do some JVs.
I'd love to. The city's awesome.
You're calling, we'll say, Salt Lake City economic developer.
Yeah.
Saying, hey, my name is Tyler. I build strip malls. And they say, go somewhere more rural, probably.
Probably, yeah.
So yeah. Like, what is that conversation?
So it doesn't work as well in Dallas or yeah. Austin, right? It works yeah. in these smaller towns. But like these towns that are getting thousands and thousands of homes. And so we go to them and our first question almost always to them is, hey, what do you need? Like, what is it that, like, I don't know your city as well as you know your city. You guys live here. You, all your friends live here. You maybe grew up here. Like, you know what people are calling your office, the residence. Like, what is it that you guys need? And
they say, no more apartments.
They say, no more apartments. They say,
sit down restaurants.
They say, we're tired of these 18 wheelers.
Yeah.
Oftentimes. But retail, they love retail.
They do love retail.
They love retail. Patioed restaurants. Mm. That is the thing. Drive-thrus are getting a little bit iffy, but patioed restaurants and a path to patio restaurants is, that is the number one thing. And they'll say, look, we don't want any more nail salons. We don't want any more chicken places. We don't want any more donut shops. And we'll say, listen, we need those things. They like, clearly more of them come. So, you know, they're opening for a reason and people are shopping there. But, you know, we'll build 10,000 square feet. We're gonna put this big patio over here and you're gonna get your patio restaurant. We'll get the other tenants to fill out the center and it's like a perfect match. And from there, they are calling everyone they know. They're sending me phone numbers, emails, this property, this property, this property. And most of them aren't, you know, great or ideal, but again, it's just filtering. And you get, if you get 12 properties from an EDC, like you're bound to find one of them. And once you just like, if you meet with a city and you start trying to do with like developers and cities have this history of like this weird relationship where everyone seems to hate each other. And I don't know why that should be the case. I mean, I understand why it's the case, but you know, if you provide something that the community actually wants and you provide something that they know the residents want, I just think long-term it's going to do better.
Yeah.
The tenants will do better. The landlord will do better. The city will love it.
A win-win-win.
It's, you know? it's a very retail, that's a very retail thing. But yeah, it really goes hand in hand, what we're trying to do, what they want. And so we have found, cities to be a great source of opportunities.
This is great insight right here. One of the best days of my life was, when I was at Planning Commission and I was presenting like my retail project. I was just a simple guy, Jiffy Lube, drive through, strip mall, whatever.
Yep.
And there was a 1,000-unit master plan community at the same time. And people had their pitchforks. And then as soon as I got up there, it was all quiet. Then the developer got up there and everyone was pissed.
Yeah.
And I was just, it was so great because it wasn't on me. So
yeah.
That was a great time. Okay. So
never good to be that guy.
Let's say EDC sends you a deal. You like it. How are you underwriting that? Like, what do you look for as far as, do you care about credit? Do you care like yield on cost, IRR? Like, how do you care about real estate?
So I will do some very high level back of the envelope map. Like, I've got the most simple spreadsheet where it's really like work. There are kind of three ways you compete, right? You compete on quality, compete on location, you're competing on basis. And so when we're looking at the numbers, we're really thinking about it from a basis perspective. Yeah, it's yield on cost mostly. We know what a building should cost. We know what site work is, deal, you know, project to project. You have TI, you have LC, you have your carry, you know, taxes, insurance, very basic things. If there's any debt service, but it's really not that many line items. Mm-hmm. And then you're just trying to, the hardest part is figuring out the rent. And it's, I think, a little bit easier for us though to figure out rents on new construction than it is for people buying existing. Like, the reason people are great at value-add deals is because they're very good at understanding what the rents are. Because I think there's just more like examples of, oh, this new construction building next door just got these rents. Like, it's kind of easier to find comps that make sense versus I'm going to like renovate this building, but I'm the only one renovating this building on this block. So that's the hardest part. But yeah, we're typically trying to get double digits yield on cost, and we're
that's killer.
And we're hoping to sell like we underwrite sevens on the exit. The last thing we sold was a 6.5. Nice. Everything I've been told is like in the 6 and 6.5 range. But that's what we try to do. But like, I try not to stay beholden to the numbers. I kind of feel like
we're vibes.
Seriously though.
No, seriously. We are vibes.
I understand. So. I understand. Yeah. It's like what you're trying to do is find this intersection of there's some deals where the numbers check out, but your gut's kind of like
Vibes are off.
And there's deals where your instincts are like really into this, but the numbers don't quite check out. Like, but the deals you're looking for are the ones where both of them come together. And I feel like the problem with just doing numbers is it kind of like the sites that are bad tend to look better on paper, and the sites that are amazing tend to look a little bit worse. I think it's just because like the spectrum of results, right?
Yeah.
Like you're getting more of a discount on the land that's worse. You're paying more closer to the full price on the better land. But like, if you're looking at it from like the spectrum results, there's better, so many more ways the gray land's going to go well. And there's so many ways the bad land's going to go bad, but you can't, it's hard to underwrite all these sensitivities. And so if the math checks out, but we feel like this is a great site and we can compete on quality, we can compete on location and the math checks out. Like that's the kind of site where we're trying to go all in on.
I think there's a lot to be said about a good location. Here's another, this is one of my favorite like 0% interest rate policy things that's ever like benefited me.
Yeah.
I was remodeling a foreclosed house in like probably the wealthiest neighborhood in Salt Lake.
Yeah.
And pretty much everything that went wrong could go wrong with that project. The neighbor didn't really like the project. Like he didn't like the way the house looked. He ended up buying it from me for damn near full price and bulldozed it.
No,
I
really?
Shit you not. So this was over $1 million for the loan, and I was like,
just a bulldozer?
Yeah. So
wow. Did you buy the site again and rebuild something?
It's for sale right now.
Yeah. You just keep building things for the next 12 years.
Yeah.
Selling to the same guy.
Yeah. So maybe
good for him. That guy is awesome.
No, he is awesome. He also took a lot of pain away from me. I was like, please take this from me. So
yeah.
Okay. So
great location. That's
yeah,
what,
exactly. Yeah,
you get bailed out so much more when you just got a great property.
Yeah.
And like, we're always looking for outlier buyers, and you're always looking for tenants that like will overpay because they like when you're competing on quality and location, you're not competing on cost, right? So that therefore a tenant's willing to pay a lot more, a buyer's willing to pay a lot more. When you're competing on value, on like this is a great value, then cost is front and center in the whole conversation.
Yep.
And so I think it's easier to outperform when you're competing on quality and location. But you know, at some point you get so high in rents that it's like, no matter how nice you are, nobody's going to lease this because they just can't sell enough sandwiches.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So we talked about design. Let's talk about financing first, and then we'll get into construction. I'm excited to talk about construction. It's just you, your brother, and your dad who would do these deals, right? And I guess talk about what you guys do, what each of you do in that process.
So we are very fortunate, and it's the coolest thing about my job is that I get to work with my brother, my dad, and we're very much a team where we kind of need all three of us. It's primarily me and my brother, where I'm in the office quite a bit, and my brother is on site quite a bit. But when we have multiple projects, we're all flying around everywhere. And so my dad and my brother are more of the experts in construction. My dad in particular I don't know there's many people in the country who built more retail construction than he has. And so most of the, you know, it's why, you know, I take a lot of pride in how much that's helped our company, but also know that that's not any of my experience, and so very fortunate with that. But my brother now is you know, just as good as anyone in the retail construction game, and it's nice having my dad's kind of like the break glass in case of emergency, where it's like, okay, we've never seen this problem before. Have you seen this? And you're like 40-year career as a contractor. So I come from the finance world. I work private equity, and they both come from the construction world. And so we realized, the whole reason we started this company is we realized that between the three of us, we can do the entire development process ourselves, and we can really take out a lot of the third parties that I think cost a lot of money in these projects, and really strip it down to bare bones.
So
that wasn't a financing answer at all.
No, that's okay. So I guess let's get into the financing now. So, are you using banks, credit unions, debt funds? How does this work?
So I get encouraged that I need to be talking more to debt funds and things like that, but I'm very much a relationship guy where if we find someone we like working with, someone we trust, someone we work, you know, we want to do as much with that one group as possible. That goes for lenders, that goes for architects, that goes for engineers, that goes for tenants, that goes for subs, and the lending world is not any different. Back, you know, with debt, when debt was so cheap, you know, you have many options, right? You can put a lot of capital in and get very little debt. You can put a lot of debt in, you can get investors. When debt was so cheap, it like didn't make sense to get investors.
Yeah.
Like why pay somebody else, you know, 15, 20, 30, you know, however well you did on the deal, 40%, when you could pay a lender, you know, 3.25%.
Yeah.
Right. And so that never made any sense to me. As interest rates have gone up, we're using more and more equity because it's shifted. It's not that we have to, it's just that like...
I have to.
You know, I always wanted to get to a place where I didn't have much debt. Honestly, I want to get a place where there's no debt. My whole feeling is that the more debt you use, the more projects you're going to do because you're going to invest all your capital, right?
Yeah.
And I find you just do... The more you spread yourself out, the worse you do. But you concentrate a lot of your equity into one deal, then you're hyper-focused on that one deal. And I think you can outperform that deal a lot more and make up for a lot of the loss. Plus, debt means you make less money on an individual deal. And it's hard enough making money.
Like, it is hard enough.
Why give away some of that money when you don't have to? So we still use debt. We're progressively using less and less debt. You know, with the first deal we ever did, we had 5 acres and we ended up flipping a piece of it at closing. We had like land, can't remember what the numbers were, but it was like we had under contract for $12 a foot. We closed at $12 a foot, but immediately sold a piece for $16 a foot.
That's good.
And then we were able to use the profits from that as kind of our equity. And so we intended to put money into this company and then we never really had to. Because we got lucky with that that first one. And now we've just been kind of rolling the profits into more and more deals. Look, I should have done more deals. I should have been more aggressive with debt in 2019 and 2018. And just because I didn't foresee the rent growing, construction costs and all that. But I sleep a lot better at night. The pain of blowing up as a developer feels a lot worse than the enjoyment of getting, you know, very wealthy. So I'd rather take it easy.
If the pain of blowing up is nearly as bad as it is almost blowing up, it's really bad.
Yeah.
I share the same thoughts on debt, but just more because I'm a scared little boy than anything. Yeah. So
I think it's probably so hard because everyone is hearing about how much money people are making in real estate. And debt is just, it's a double-edged sword, and it makes great operators way better. It makes them way more money. It makes bad operators way worse.
Yep.
And I feel like the bad operators end up getting more debt and the great operators get less debt. And so it's
funny.
It's a funny thing, but it's, I feel for everybody who's got floating rate debts and things like that. Sleeping at night is a underrated currency in this business.
Exactly. Okay, now let's get into construction. Mm-hmm. So you guys are unique, obviously, mm-hmm. because you don't hire third-party GCs.
Right.
And I want to highlight like how expensive a third-party, love my third-party GCs, but how expensive they are on a $3, $4, or $5 million project in relation to the actual cost.
Yeah, well, just think of it, start bigger, right? If you think of like a massive project, right? Something that's hundreds of millions of dollars, like that is a GC, like when you look at things from a percent basis, something could be a tiny, tiny percent and still be millions and millions and millions of dollars, right? When you get down to our level, like 3%, 4% isn't that much money. And construction is such a risky business. Like, you know, you're trying a contractor, it makes sense for them to find where the risk and the return kind of balance each other out. And so I don't know. So we don't pay a GC. So there's no GC fee. There's no general conditions. All the buyout money that they get, like, you know, a lot of people split that, but we get all of that.
Can you explain what buyout is? Like, what that means?
The simplest thing is that, like, if you're not in construction, the simplest way to think about it is that someone's going to go back, the GC is going to go back for like one last bite of the apple with a sub. Mm-hmm. And they're going to try to, get the lowest price on when they're selecting him, like one last time, let me get some savings. And so, there's a lot of gray areas in the numbers when like you signing a contract with the GC and then they're signing all these contracts with the subs and, there's savings and costs that can go along the way. And, we're trying to by being our own GC, we know exactly where all the costs are. And I think we streamline the process a lot more. And so, you know, you're saving on the fees and the general conditions, but you're also just saving on general, like GCs are trying to make profits in construction. There's a lot of gray area. And so, you know, how much are we saving it? Is it 15%, 20%, 30%? It's hard to know because you don't know the exact deal. You don't know. There's no like two jobs that are like,
yeah,
perfectly comparable, but based on the rent savings that we have compared to other developers, we seem to get like a $4 to $5 rent savings typically, historically, versus other developers. So I kind of feel like we're probably saving $30 to $40 a foot, or, you know, 20, 30. Again, it changes year to year, yeah, and things like that. Some of the savings isn't just from like eliminating the GC. Some of it's just our subs give us great pricing because instead of money going from the lender to the owner to the GC to the sub, like you have all these different layers, and now the work is getting paid 45 or 60 days later than it should have. If we pay a sub 3 days after they're finished, or 2 days, or 1 day, or on the spot, like, you finish this by Friday, I will write you a check on the spot. We'll get lien waiver signed and we'll be done. Like, if you do that, I promise you'll get a lot better pricing. And so we do that a lot with our subs. And so I think our subs give us a lot of credit for that. Mm-hmm. They know that we're going to schedule things efficiently. So if there's a problem on site, right, we're going to be there to figure it out, get the architect on the phone, get the engineer on the phone, and solve it right there. So nobody's just waiting around, and a subs is not just like wasting time and wasting, and everyone's so busy, right? And so that's where a lot of the savings come from. And then a lot of it's just like being efficient. So like, we probably shave a month and a half off construction versus other people. And that's carry. That gets your tenants in quicker with rent. And it kind of changes the yield on cost analysis a little bit.
Back to construction schedule. So first, want to talk about material selection. Mm-hmm. So
simple.
Let's go into more detail on the simple. So is it?
So you have to, you're really building these buildings for like so many different people, right? You're building it for the tenants. You're building it for the city. You're building it for the buyer. You're building it for your lender. And you're building it for the customers that are going to come in the store. And so, there's a bunch of different things you're trying to balance with that. But I think like first and foremost, you're trying to create the highest quality building you can at the most economical cost that you can, right? You're trying to create a building where a tenant thinks that, okay, the rent on this building is I'm getting a good deal on this rent because this building's so nice, but the rent is so, so cheap. Anyone can build a incredible, beautiful building with 1,000 different materials. And but like what we're trying to do is we're really trying to keep it simple, and it's on us to find a way to make good designs and really attractive properties by keeping it simple. And so a lot of that is just using different kinds, like maybe we use brick all the way around the building, but we're doing certain patterns here and there, and we're doing we're changing up the colors as we go through. And so like color selection is really critical, and those kinds of things. On landscaping, like we're trying to spend our dollars really wisely on landscaping so that we can make a really nice and inviting center. Even on like where you put the dumpster and how the dumpster, like you don't want anybody to see the dumpster or feel like they're walking past the dumpster when they're trying to go to the store. Like all those things make the store more inviting. And so I think like we err on the side of like clean and crisp and simple and things that we know will work rather than like trying to take some big swings. I think I would love to take more big swings because I think it's all, everyone loves to go to a city where the buildings are unique and different. And I do think that's better for the city's long term. We're just at a place now where unless land cost, all the pricing go like funnels down to land cost, right? And so it's just not, we're just not a place right now where you can build these centers, go crazy on design. And so we try to keep it as much of a rectangle as possible, you know, literally straight lines, right? We're doing towers on the end caps. We're not trying to go crazy with the design. We're using different color brick. I think you make a building that looks really nice, looks really new. You can do some really cool canopies. You see a lot of like medical professionals get into the space and design a building that's like beautiful and like expensive. They're going to be the end cap on, they're going to be the dentist. That's the end cap. And so they design it really beautifully. And then when it comes time to build, they realize the numbers don't work. So it's a challenge, but you've got to find a way to balance it. And that's the job is finding a way to make the city, the customers, the tenants, everybody, you know, the eventual buyer happy. There's something to like trying to let the tenants, you know, in a way with their signage, like I'm always trying to think about like, I don't want to make sure my building's not taking too much away from the tenants and their signage as well. So there's a lot of things that go into it, but, you know, that's a very important thing that we do. And we've gotten our design to be really efficient. So that means when we use the same subs, they know exactly what our building is going to be. They can price it really efficiently. We get it approved very quickly because
this is my dream.
Because we've eliminated all the mistakes.
Yeah.
Yeah. If you could stick to one product type, Tanner, you could repeat drawings and things like that. And then we learn a little bit on each one too. So we tweak it and make it a little bit better. But there's a lot of ways to make these buildings look nice. I think you owe it to your tenants to give them a chance to survive. And part of that is by building a project that can offer a rent that makes sense for them.
You mentioned reusing drawings. And I have this in my notes because I wanted to ask you. Mm. Are you just going to the architect and saying like, hey, I'm building the same building, like do it cheaper this time? Or like, how does that work?
It's never the same drawings. It's always improved. Mm-hmm. But we're always kind of starting from the same place, right? Okay. Like these buildings aren't, like I'm not, like there are so many wildly talented developers who are building incredible things.
You're looking at it.
like Tanner in Salt Lake City, who should get all the rewards and the like I love what they're doing. We're like filling a very specific niche in our market. And so like, while some people are providing great experiences, even in retail, by creating this amazing, unique type of retail experience, we're providing a great experience by being convenient, by being efficient, because you can have your kid crying in the back seat and go through the drive-thru or sleep in the back seat because the rent is low enough where the sandwich is low, you know, prices aren't crazy. Like, it's a different experience. It's serving a different need.
It's less sexy.
It's less sexy, yeah. but it's a part of the daily life of the lives of a lot of people. I want to be clear that as strip center developers, we are not doing we're doing a job that is not sexy, and it's not like, I feel like sometimes real estate developers make their job sound heroic.
Yeah.
It's Definitely not that.
No, I love talking about building industrial buildings because I'm building like tenants. I'm building for tenants that are the backbone of America.
Yeah.
That's about the extent that I get to. So you mentioned drive-throughs. I thought you didn't like drive-throughs.
I do like drive-throughs. It's funny. Drive-throughs are good for us, but they are better for single tenant developments, right? So they make an incremental value. It's more accretive to their project than it is to our projects. And so even though it's better for us, it's almost in a weird way better for it to be banned where we want to be, because then land prices reflect no drive-throughs. Mm. And so, and drive-throughs create a site plan challenge for us, right? It's the ideal project for us is we have 10,000 square feet. We've got, again, row parking, fire lane, row parking, 15 spots plus 15 spots, maybe like 12 with the handicap. So you have 27, and then you have another 10 on this side and 10 on this side, or you know, whatever, and then you have 15 and 15 on the back, and you can start, you can get to 6 per thousand, 7 per thousand very efficiently, very quickly in a really efficient site plan. All the parking is up against, most of the parking is up against the building or in front of the building. Mm. Now throw in a drive-through that has to have 200 plus feet of stacking, and you have to put it all the way around the building. And so like now you have to go wider and you just scoot your parking out, but do you need to have a bailout lane? And on the back of the building, like you have to have the, you know, the order board and the menus and the menu board. And it creates site plan challenges and you just lose square footage, right? Where that drive-through lane is, that should be more building if there wasn't a drive-through. And so you're constantly doing this math of like, okay, I'm losing square footage, but I'm getting more rent, but I'm, you know, I have all these extra costs that go into it, but I'm not building as much building, but I also, you know, I get, might be getting a better credit tenant. And so you're trying to balance that. We're almost forced to do drive-throughs, and they just do so well that like we're never unhappy to have a drive-through. But I do think in a strange way, it would actually make our business better if there were no drive-throughs anywhere. But I love drive-throughs, so I hope they...
I love them too.
Yeah.
I love just eating in my truck. It's one of my... it's a great American pastime.
Yeah. You know? Once I had a kid, I was like, okay, I get it.
Yeah.
I get it. It's I've always heard that their sales are like 25 to 30% more than they would be if it was a non-drive-through. And so I don't see the rent quite that gap quite there yet.
Yeah.
But I assume eventually that it's going to be a 25, 30% gap on rent. And I kind of think that should be on total rent dollars, not per square foot. But I have to think about...
Interesting.
I have to think about that.
Going back to construction, because I have lots of questions about construction.
Yeah, this has been so sporadic. I'm sorry.
Yeah. No, we're just going all over the place. I actually have good notes this time, though, so it's great. Critical path of construction.
Right.
You're building stuff about the speed of light, but you still have bottlenecks. Like, you can't start framing a building until you have your foundation in.
Right.
So, like, what are the big bottlenecks that you really look at?
So, I don't know if this is a Texas... The funny thing about my construction experience is, again, I don't come from construction. I learned construction from being a superintendent on our site and learning day to day. And so I have like, I sometimes use the wrong words and things like that. So forgive me if I do that. But in Texas, the biggest bottlenecks we have are, one, obviously like the weather can impact a lot of things. And we have very wet seasons and extremely dry seasons. But the first goal, first and foremost, is how do we get rain to be a non-issue? Like, how do we get concrete everywhere as much as possible? Because that's going to be your biggest hang up. The two that come to mind, first of all, is going vertical is huge. And so for us to go vertical, the key is we need to have enough fire lane. Typically, some cities have different rules. We have to have enough fire lane. It's not the entire fire lane, but enough fire lane so that the fire department can bring fire trucks and ambulances just in case. And so they won't let us go vertical. So like in theory, you could have your steel ready. You could have your pad done. You could have the, you know, you're ready to go vertical, except the city's not letting you because you don't have the fire lines in.
Yep.
And so this is where design of the site becomes important, and that when we're looking at our site, we're always looking for how can we get this building to go vertical first. And so a lot of time that means is putting as much of our utilities in one part of the site and leaving one part of the site as empty as possible from a utility perspective.
Mm-hmm.
And so if that part doesn't have any utilities underneath it, and that fire lane allows us to go vertical more quickly, the sooner we pay, we can pay that so much quicker because we don't have to do any utilities underneath it, right? We can get that graded and paved, and then that allows us to go vertical. So we're going vertical, and we still have like many weeks left on our utilities, right?
Yeah.
We're still doing it, but we moved all of our utilities to the areas that don't need to get, that don't, you know, prohibit us going vertical, and we keep it clean underneath where, so that's one thing. And then we're stacking subs. When we're doing the masonry around the building, that's always an interesting one because the getting power to the building is obviously important, mostly because it's hard to guarantee that you're going to get power. Like you're waiting to get the meter set, you're waiting to get these inspections. And so we're putting brick up on the back high enough to get our tap cans and get all of our electrical on the back so we can get that inspection going as quickly as possible. We're also trying to get the brick done on the front of the building as quickly as possible so we can get the storefront measured and get the glass ordered so that that doesn't become a bottleneck. Like if we, so when we're doing the masonry, we have to look at it closely to understand what do we need to prioritize based on what's going to take the longest. Sometimes it's the electrical company, sometimes it's glass, sometimes it's whatever it may be. You know, glass was interesting because we used to, it used to be like 5 days. They come and field measure it, and then you have it in 5 days. At the peak of like the supply chain issues, it got up to 12 weeks maybe. So our project's 4.5 months total. And so like, and it's one of the last things we do. So if we waited to field measure it and then called it in at that point, wait 12 weeks, our building would be sitting there for 12 weeks and wouldn't be open. It'd be like 99% done.
Yeah.
But we'd be waiting on it. And so when we had that problem, we went ahead and ordered the glass with our best guess.
Oh man.
And then just hoped enough of it fit where we could just replace certain little panels, and we try to break up the glass a little more. So if there's issues, there'd be smaller, you know, to replace. But I think that's where you find the bottlenecks is a lot of times it's materials, it's going vertical, and then it's getting the third party electrical, gas, whatever it may be, like not the city utilities, but the third parties. That's where you're trying to get give them as much time as possible because you just have no control over them.
That is a ordering glass without having exact measurements is it's a little terrifying for me.
I mean, we got some measurements and we got like as soon as but it was 12 weeks. Like it's as an owner, the math in our head was we knew we could get the CO if we put like, you know, just temporary like wood for like a little bit. Because the tenants take 3 to 5 months to build out their space anyways. We knew we could get our CO and turn the building over to our tenants. But it was worth the risk knowing that we probably were going to spend thousands of dollars to get it fixed. But if it gets our tenants in 12 weeks sooner, that's, from a rent perspective, it makes up for that.
That's good. So speaking of leasing, do you hire a broker or do you lease it in house? How does that work?
We kind of do both. So a landlord rep is going to make 2% commissions on base rents. So it doesn't include triple nets on our deals. And that's not a lot of money. I think a lot of landlords expect their leasing team to care as much as they do about their project.
Yeah.
And
you're going to bust your ass for $500. Like, come on.
And so no one, I don't think you're ever going to get the type of commitment from them as you'd love because it's totally unrealistic. However, when we're finding deals, a lot of times, again, it's another sourcing strategy that everyone does, is that if you can find a deal and a broker is listing the property, you tell them, hey, you can get my side of the commission and you can get the leasing assignment. Like that can give you access to the deal in a way that is pretty useful.
That's they say the strongest force in the universe is a broker between both sides of the commission. Then you add that layer on top of that. So.
Yeah, you only have so many ways to incentivize brokers. It's the upfront commission, it's the leasing commissions, it's the sale commissions.
Yeah.
And you want to use them as much as possible. We've hired a different leasing broker on almost every project.
Yeah.
I think they're all very good. And I think some of them are exceptional and some of them, we're going to make calls and calls and calls and calls and calls because we have one or two or three centers we're worried about when they have many centers they're worried about. And so we're just going to spend a lot more time doing it. But they also have a lot of relationships that are valuable and they know tenants sometimes better than we do. And so it ends up being about maybe like 60, they get tenants, 40% we get tenants.
Huh.
And I don't know how much of that is who's got their name on the sign, but the leasing brokers do a great job. It's just, again, it's just unrealistic to expect them to spend all this time on your project.
I can't believe more people don't understand that.
Yeah.
Like, show me the incentives, show me the outcome, or show me the incentives, I'll show you the outcome, whatever that saying is. And it's like,
one more time, you got it.
So, but it's like, you just pay people more. Like, that's how you get jobs. And like, give them both sides of the commission, you give them the leasing. So wanted to take an opportunity to plug our deal incentive program that we have. Extra 50 basis points of commission, option to co-invest, and then you get first dibs on leasing and selling. So if you've got a great industrial deal in Salt Lake City, hit me up. We'll take care of you. So
I think a nice thing for brokers too is if you pay them a lease signing.
Yep.
The brokers run the system and they spend years and years and years building these relationships and it's silly to not use them to help you.
Yeah.
And it's silly to fight them when it makes such a now there are times when like there are brokers involved who like aren't contributing, who like want to get paid. And like I think as a landlord, like you've gotta it's not just about like paying them, it's make sure you're paying the right person. So if your commission's getting split three ways, but only one person's getting paid, like that's rough for the one person getting paid because they're getting paid even less. So what we try to do is if there's going to be a leasing commission, we want to get as much of that amount to go to them, not to the house, not to these other brokers, as possible to them who's doing the work so that they can feel as incentivized as possible.
Yep. In this podcast, we've had a lot of technical difficulties and we've also built an entire strip center and we've leased it. How do you think about exit strategies? Do you want to just own a bunch of 10,000 square foot retail buildings or do you want to roll them up and sell them to Blackstone? What is your thought process on that?
I want to be someone who can own all of them. It's so hard. What's really challenging is I feel like I will have a value in my head of what I think this is worth. And in our business, let's say we're building to like $4 million and we're selling to like $6 million, right? That's $5 to $6 million price point, I think is really good for individual buyers, maybe 1031 buyers, someone who is going to value bonus depreciation. And it's really good for them to overpay a little bit, right? And so, do I want to sell any of my centers? No. We build every center assuming that we're going to hold it forever. We finance it that way. We use structural steel because of that. Like we build our buildings to last because we assume we're going to hold them forever. But when somebody offers you a price that you think is higher than it's worth, like what do? Like there's going to be transaction cost. You have to go find another project. Like these buildings only appreciate. There's like long-term appreciation with leases rule, but like the rent bumps are only 2% a year, 3% a year, 1.5% a year. Could we go do more with our money elsewhere? Probably. Then we have to find a new deal with more risk.
More work.
Yeah. It's a challenging question. It's hard to grow just buying it only unless you just, and what made it harder is when we got cheap debt on these things. It's like, okay, we could refinance, but I don't want to refinance now and pull money out with like a... Yeah. And again, I don't want to put on more debt, right? So that's where the balance comes is the fewer assets I own, the less debt I'm going to have. And so the less things that can go wrong at any point. Like And the more I transition from one project to the next project, the more I can de-lever like our platform, right? Yeah. But you build a relationship with these tenants. You know, in retail, it very much feels like the businesses are our businesses. And so it's tough letting them go. I never regretted selling a building until the last one I sold. This was the first one where I think I've come to the point now where I think that was a bad choice. And so I think going forward, I'm going to hold more than I have previously, but it's always the part of it that it's hard for me to wrap my head around is even if you're getting non-recourse loans and things like that, it's just like, I don't know, it's hard to, it's you're either growing with debt or you're growing with selling, and which one do you want to do?
Yep. I've had so much fun today.
Yeah.
Other than the technical difficulties, this was great.
Great.
Come back anytime.
This is part one of our 8-part series with Strip Center Development.
I would love to do that. So cool.
Yeah, thanks we were again. Very high level today, but there's quite a bit of detail that goes into these things.
Yep. Well, you're welcome back every time. Thanks, man.
Awesome. Thanks.